school. I've spent a fair bit of time over the last few days in a school environment. Corth Lakes Bible College is on the outskirts of Peterborough. It's a beautiful campus. This is not the building, but at the same time, it's a building kind of like this, and there's several floors, there's several rooms in the building, and we have a good time when we're there. I actually live right in the building. They've got a couple of basement apartments for any professors who are visiting, and we had a good time with teaching two courses. I taught a course in evangelism and a course in Christian counseling. We had the cold like you had a few days ago. In fact, one morning I walked into the classroom and the temperature read 51 degrees Fahrenheit. They had a problem with the furnace. I said to the students, I like teaching when things have got a little bit of a crisp edge, but that might be a little bit too crisp. We had to look for another part of the building. But my guess is all of you at one time or another have been in school. Some of you attended public school. Many of you went through high school. My guess is in our group this morning, some of you were college students. Some of you went on to university. Some of you maybe were in a professional school. Some of you were in a trade school. But this morning, we're going to be looking at a different kind of school. This is a school that we are going to call the desert school. It's not so much a place, but a state. And it's not the state of Arizona or Nevada or anywhere else you might think have deserts, but this is kind of a state. It's what you find yourself in. There are those who choose to go to the desert school, but in most cases, we're forced either through the circumstances or situations of life, and we end up finding ourselves in the desert school. There are all kinds of different courses at the desert school. Some folks are in the desert school for just a few months or years. Some of us end up in the desert school for a long, long time. And this morning, we want to think about the desert school. In fact, it's one of God's very favorite waiting places for us. Now, when I arrived at the school Sunday night, first thing on the Monday morning, I was given a class list for both courses I was teaching, who were taking those courses, and I went down the list, and it was quite interesting to see who was on the list, who had signed up for the different courses. I've got a class list for the desert school, and I'm just reviewing it now. And there's some of you sitting on this side of the auditorium, and you're in the desert school. You may not be aware of it, but that's the school that you're in. Let me take a look here in the middle section. Don't worry, I'm not going to do a roll call, but I'm actually quite surprised. There are many of you in the middle section who are in the desert school. Oh boy, I see even more names on this side. And guess what? You're in the desert school. We're studying Moses. And one thing you need to know about Moses is Moses spent a long time in the desert school. In fact, we know that he was in the desert school for 40 years. What you also need to know about Moses is he would end up going back a few times between his ages 80 and 120 back into the desert school. God had many lessons for Moses to learn in the desert school. We have a record of Moses in the desert school, quite specifically, the desert school of Midian. What's kind of neat is we really don't know where Midian is located. But what we do know is that Moses was in a place where God was going to prepare him for what was next in his life. So will you come with me this morning? We're going to watch and we're going to learn from Moses some insights and lessons that will help all of us who find ourselves in the desert school. Let me just go back one slide. What we want to begin with is what I've called pondering failure and other setbacks that enroll us in the desert school. And let's look at Moses' experience. It's a text that's in your bulletin, and it's also here on the screen behind me. Now, we left Moses on a high point. Remember last week we said that Moses was incredibly famous in Egypt. He was the most handsome man in the world. He was perhaps the most educated man in the world. He was very smart. He had everything going for him. And then Moses made a choice, and we praised that choice last week. Moses chose to be identified with the suffering people of Israel rather than enjoying the pleasures of Egypt, and that was a remarkable choice. We left Moses on a very high note. Moses had read his press clippings. Moses felt that he was ready to lead. Moses felt that he was ready to do something incredibly significant for God. If you had asked Moses, he would say, "I'm ready to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt." Let's see what happens next. One day, after Moses had grown up, he is now 40 years old, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" The man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. What we do know of Midian was it was a desert place. It was a wilderness place. It was an obscure place. And this is where Moses found himself. Now, we wish there was more said in this text. We do have the advantage of Stephen's prayer in Acts chapter 7 that's recorded for us that gives a history of Israel and keys in on this event or these series of events. We also have what is written in Hebrews 11. There's a lot of debate over Moses' action. On the surface, it would sure appear that Moses did the right thing. After all, he had made a choice to identify with the suffering people of Israel, his Hebrew people, and they were being oppressed and tyrannized by the Egyptians. So it would seem to be the right thing to do. It would seem to be a thing to do with the right motives when he went out and he killed the Egyptian. But the problem is, while it might have been motivated for the right reasons, his way of going about things, his method, the way he expressed himself was wrong. And I've looked at a lot of commentators, a lot of folks who've speculated on this incident in chapter 2, and I think it is safe to say that when Moses killed that Egyptian man, he did something that just wasn't right. It was a mistake, it was an error, it was failure. Moses did something that just wasn't right. Barton, who's written the latest book on Moses, and I think she's done a wonderful job, speculates maybe further than I would want to go, but she said, there's got to be some explanation for the absolute rage that we see here with Moses. Moses was fueled by that sense of injustice. He was fueled by the sense that this is not right, what the Egyptians were doing to the Israelites. But something sparked within him, and he did something that would seem to be very much out of how God would have wanted this situation handled. In fact, what's interesting to me is that there's nothing said that indicates to us that God prompted Moses to act in this way. I find it interesting that Moses tried to hide what he had done. He tried to cover it up. So what you have is this person experiencing anger. And I've said from this platform before that anger itself is not sin. One can experience righteous anger, and it's very appropriate. The problem with Moses was that he expressed anger in a way that wasn't appropriate. This was rage. This was out of control. He ended up hiding the body of the Egyptian. So, of course, he goes out the next day, and maybe Moses thought, I've covered this up. I've still demonstrated that I'm on the side of the Hebrews. I've identified with my own people. And we're told in Acts that Moses was quite convinced that this was the time that he was to make his move and to lead the people of Israel out of Egypt. But then he sees these two fellows fighting, and he asks what seems to be a very direct question, and the man who is in the wrong responds, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Moses, we've seen that you've got a bad temper. We've seen how reckless you were in this situation. What makes you think that you're going to be able to rule over us, that you're going to provide the kind of leadership that we need in this situation?" And I think that was a bit of a jolt to Moses. I think Moses realized that maybe I'm not so ready to lead the people out of Egypt. And then, of course, you have Moses afraid. He's afraid that what he's done has become known. And Pharaoh hears of this. Now, what's interesting is that in the account in Hebrews, you get the impression that Moses wasn't really scared silly of Pharaoh. But I'm going to suggest to you that with what was going on, I think Moses, to some point, was afraid of himself. How do I explain what's going on within me? Was there an element of identity confusion? We see it later in the text in chapter 2 that while Moses had made this choice, he was born a Hebrew, he became an Egyptian, and there's some indicators to us that he had a sense of being unsettled. One might even go as far as saying, though he had a wonderful mom, and likely the princess of Egypt was good with him, that there was still a level of discontent maybe and dysfunction. So I'd suggest to you that Moses maybe wasn't as afraid of Pharaoh as he was afraid of himself. What's going on with me? Why is this happening? And it's this failure, it's this mistake, what some will go as far as saying, Moses' sin in this situation that caused him to flee, that caused him to run, that ended up with him enrolling in the school of the desert. Now, I've indicated earlier that it's not just failure, it's not just errors or sin that end us up in the desert school. It can be other setbacks. Sometimes it's something we've done wrong. Sometimes it's something that someone has done to us that's wrong. Sometimes it's just a circumstance or a situation of life. Illness can end up or lead you into the desert school. Losing or being fired from a job, you might find yourself in the desert school. A broken romance, you might find you end up in the desert school. Sometimes it's something going on with someone else in your life, a spouse or a child. There's all kinds of situations that put you into the desert school. My friends in Toronto, there's nothing desert about Toronto, but on Thursday, they entered into the desert school. And you know, many of you, that often as someone is in that desert school, you come to visit, you sometimes come to be there with them when they're in that desert school. But the desert school is a place of waiting. It's a place of waiting on God. It's a time where we have opportunity to do what we need to do so God can use us for what's next, the next big thing that he has for us. And here's the thing I find quite alarming about Moses. Moses was convinced that he was ready at that time to lead the people out of Egypt. And God, in a very powerful way, says, "You're not ready. There's more to be done in your life." And what I've discovered, I bet you've discovered, is that God's timing sometimes doesn't coincide with my timing. And often, many of you, I look out this morning, I can think of situations and circumstances in your life where you are waiting. And in the desert school, there are many places, there are many rooms where we find ourselves waiting. I have a couple of quotes that I want to use just before we look at some of the courses and some of the teachings in the Desert School. But when it comes to the matter of leaders, and leaders particularly, God has a special department in the Desert School for leaders, but also for those who are servants. And you can substitute some of the ideas about leadership and apply it very much into your situation. Parker Palmer's been around. He, I think, has done some of the best writing on the psychology of leadership. And this is a quote I've seen over the years. Barton refers to it a couple of times in her book. Powerful quote. I was just going to read it, and I thought, no, it's got to be on the screen because it's one that really, I think, should resonate with many of us. A leader is a person who must take special responsibility for what's going on inside him or herself, inside his or her consciousness, lest the act of leadership create more harm than good. That's one of those statements you pull back from and you realize that what goes on inside of me is very significant in terms of how I lead, how I serve, in terms of who I'm working with, who I rub shoulders with, and I believe that Palmer is onto it. Another book that has come out just recently is by McIntosh, who does a lot of good work in church leadership, and he's joined up with a fellow named Rima. And this is what they say. They call this the dark side of leadership. Could you ever believe there's such a thing? The dark side of leadership, the dark side of service, the dark side of being involved in church ministry. Look what they have to say. The dark side is actually a natural result of human development. If it is the inner urges, compulsions, and dysfunctions of our personality that often go unexamined or remain unknown to us, until we experience an emotional explosion or some other significant problem that causes us to search for a reason why. At times, the dark side seems to leap on us unexpectedly, but in reality, it has slowly crept on us. It has been a lifetime in the making. And so this whole idea of what was going on in Moses' inner man, and that mattered to God. God wanted to deal with Moses. And while Moses thought he was ready to lead and it would be nice and a nice flow to the book of Exodus to read that at that point Moses led as a 40-year-old the people of Israel out of Egypt, God had another plan. And it involved a 40-year stint in the Desert School. Well, let's go to I've tried to make this so that it will compel you. I've called this Professors in the Desert School. Some of the courses and lessons that they are going to teach us. I think that reads the Desert School. You could tell how my mind was working in terms of the Desert School. But it is the Desert School, and we're going to look at some of the courses and the lessons that they teach us. So let's read the passage, and then we're going to identify six teachers that have courses being taught in the Desert School. So when Pharaoh heard of this, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to the rescue and watered their flock. When the daughters returned to Reuel, whose name is also known as Jethro, they returned to their father. He asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "And where is he?" Reuel asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become a foreigner in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Now you read these verses and you go, it doesn't seem all that spectacular. Many people just choose to gloss over this section of the book of Exodus and the story of Moses. But I've suggested to you that for 40 years, Moses found himself in the desert school. And let's introduce you to some of the professors in the desert school. First of all, I want to introduce you to Professor Obscurity. And he specializes in what I'm calling a course for nobody. Think of that. Moses was a somebody in Egypt who became a nobody in Midian so that he could become someone that God would use. Did you see the pattern? He was a somebody in Egypt who became a nobody in Midian so that he could become someone that God could use. Obscurity. As I said, Midian is a very obscure place. We're not even sure where Midian was located. Obviously, somewhere outside of Egypt. We have other indications that it was a desert place, that it was a wilderness place. And this is where Moses found himself for 40 years in obscurity. The place of obscurity is where I believe Moses learned humility. He learned to be a man who would have to depend on God. Any kind of self-confidence, self-reliance was taken right out of Moses as he spent that time in Midian. So the first course is this course for becoming a nobody taught by Professor Obscurity. Let's go back. We're giving you a preview here. Professor Wells, did you notice that when Moses, he left Egypt, he ended up in Midian, and he was sitting at a well. Did you know wells are really significant in Scripture? Whenever you see a well, your antenna should go up, because a well is a place of refreshing. It's a place of rejuvenation. It's a very, very important place. Do you remember in the Gospel of John, where Jesus went to a well and he met a woman at a well, and Jesus said, I need water. She gave him water. And then Jesus in turn said, I'm going to give you living water, water that will refresh you, that will rejuvenate you. And that's what Moses needed. In a very dry period of his life, a period of frustration, where he felt so misunderstood. I did everything I could do. I thought I was doing the right thing. It turned out to be the wrong thing. Moses ended up sitting by a well. And it was at this well that he had some wonderful refreshment, that he was rejuvenated in his experience. When I was in Peterborough, some of the students told me that they joined with some men in Peterborough, and the location isn't really the key thing. They might end up in a Tim Hortons establishment. They could end up in somebody's home. But they call this men's group, I've never heard a group called this, they call it The Well. A cool name for a group, The Well. And what they do is they encourage one another. They try to stimulate each other. But they put a whole lot of focus on leaning hard on Christ, who is our source of living water. And when we find ourselves dry and thirsty, do you remember David in Psalm 63 said, I'm in a desert place. I'm in a place where there is no water. I'm thirsty. And he discovers that it's God who can satisfy our thirst. And this would become so critical for Moses, because Moses would find himself in other desert places. He would find himself in other wilderness places. He would find himself being counted on to lead people while they were in desert places. And Moses, I believe, in Midian, learn the secret of the well. So we have Professor Obscurity, Professor Wells, and then Professor Solitude. This notion of a course on silence, solitude, and self-discovery. We don't read of Moses saying anything incredibly great or wonderful. He gives his son a name, and it leaves us kind of scratching our heads. I've become an alien in a foreign place. What a name to give your son. But I think it described how Moses felt. Some of Moses' journey in terms of getting a better sense of identity. And so for Moses, God determined that he needed to slow down. He needed to have this course on silence. He needed opportunity for solitude. And we'll discover in a few minutes just another course that God provided that helped Moses in this pursuit of silence, solitude, and self-discovery. I believe, and I don't want to become over psychoanalytical, but I believe that in Midian, there were many times where Moses said, God, who am I? Who am I? I'm confused. Am I a Hebrew? Am I an Egyptian? Am I an alien in this foreign place? And I've been around people long enough to know that that's the kind of question we need to ask. Whether you're 20 or 40 or 60 or 80, Moses was somewhere between 40 and 80 where he was on this pursuit of self-discovery. Can God fill my every need? Can I find my true identity in Christ? And this for Moses became a very important thing. This course taught by Professor Solitude. Professor Service, a course on the secret to godly ministry. You know what I find neat is at the well, Moses did something really remarkable for those daughters of Jethro. Those seven daughters came with their sheep, and they were being picked on, and Moses still had that quest for justice. That was not his sin, by the way. That would fuel Moses on. Moses, we're going to discover, is going to be dealing all over with this idea of a quest for justice. And it's this sense of injustice being wrong that motivated and fueled Moses. That wasn't to be taken from him. But what I love here is that Moses is able to seek justice without having to kill somebody. And that's the big difference between what happens earlier in chapter 2 and in this instance, in this incident by the well. Moses was able to do now with the right motive, he was able to do the right thing by the right method. He was able to solve a problem, and in the process, he became a servant. He learned what it is to serve others. And the only kind of leader that God wants, we all need to hear this, the only kind of leader God wants is a servant leader. He isn't interested in somebody who's reading their press clippings. He's not interested in someone who's looking for how is this going to satisfy my needs. He's looking for someone who is totally committed to serving Christ and others. And so for Moses, we'll discover again that there was many opportunities in this course of service. But I would argue that likely his number one course, and the course that impacted every other course, was this course on shepherding. Doesn't it strike you that Moses was a key leader in Egypt? We said last week, we know from Josephus, that Moses led the Egyptians in many military battles. And God, in his wisdom, allows this great military leader to become a shepherd. Now, God blessed me this past week because in one of my classes, there was a young lady, a really delightful young lady, who lives on a sheep farm. And the first day of class, I like to ask the students, who is your favorite Bible character? And she piped up, my favorite Bible character is Moses. And I drew the connection. I said, Vanessa, you'll never believe it. I'm preaching on Moses. And he's your favorite Bible character, and you happen to live on a sheep farm. I wonder if you can give me any insights about shepherds and sheep. And she looked at me and said, I can't wait. She said, I am convinced that God had remarkable reasons for allowing Moses to become a shepherd. And she says, I hear people preach on sheep and shepherds, and oh, they're often wrong. So she said, let me tell you the goods. She said, sheep might look cute, but they're not. She said, I've got to be careful who's here. She said, I have no problem eating sheep because, she said, they're not as cute and cuddly as people might think. And she says, when we're told that we are God's flock, when Christ calls himself the great shepherd, she said, we should not stroke ourselves and feel, isn't this a compliment that we are sheep, that we are cute and cuddly? She said, it's more like we are stubborn and stiff-necked, and keep doing things wrong and wrong over and over. We complain, we mutter, you name it. She says, I have a love-hate relationship with sheep. And she said, you know, John, she says, take a field. She says, if we have a field, she says, I have to go out and spend a whole day clearing that field because, she said, sheep will eat anything. So we have to go to the full extent to make sure that we're making sure that there's nothing on that field. Because she said, sheep will eat anything. We have to really work hard to make sure they're having a proper diet. I thought, well, I can make some parallels about that when it comes to biblical teaching. And she said, you know, they have those wire fences. She says, those sheep, they'll go and they'll get stunned. And she said, if we're not careful, 2 minutes later, they're doing the same thing. She said, they are so remarkably stubborn. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure I can say that about the Byron Community Church congregation. No, I'm not going to go there. The whole idea, though, of being sheep, and another cute thing, I got to tell you this. She's talking to me at a break. And she said, yeah, she said, like, there was the day, she said, we had to get three of our sheep, our female sheep, over to a neighbor's. He had a good ram, and she said, so we had to get those three sheep into our pickup truck in order to take them over to get bread. Well, one of our young guy students comes into the conversation at that point, and she's kind of re-clarifying it. She's going, yeah, so she said, here we are pushing and pulling the sheep. We had to do all this to take those sheep to get bread. And this young guy is looking stunned. This 18-year-old is kind of, I think he thought that they were taking the sheep to the grocery store to get bread. But again, she told me, though, about being a shepherd. I said, what's it like? And she said, you know, there's lots of time to think. There's lots of quiet time. And she said, you know what? She says, being a shepherd would be incredibly humbling. That day after day, being a shepherd, working with those sheep. A couple of the young guys who became part of the conversation asked her about shearing sheep, and they said, I've seen it. Looks like a fun thing to do. And she says, not quite. But we've made an arrangement, and these two young guys are going to go with her after school is out. There's a farm up in Lindsay they're going to be working in, and they're going to have some firsthand experiencing shearing sheep. Now, you know what's interesting? That triggered my thoughts, because years ago, as a young guy, I can remember going and visiting in different churches. Sometimes I was preaching, but I would run into some older fellows, some really good leaders in the Toronto area. I remember one guy in particular. And he said to me, you know what, John? He said, my very best experience of preparing for leadership came at Ben's farm. Ben was my grandpa Johnson. And on my mom's side are farmers. And grandpa Johnson was a very strong, silent guy. He would never be one to coach people through mentoring that it would involve a lot of verbal communication. Strong, silent type, but he had a farm. And what he would do on this farm, just outside of Orillia, a place called Foxmead. Does anybody know Foxmead? Ellie does. So many of you going, it's kind of a suburb of Coldwater. Now, Coldwater you might identify with. But so here you are out in the sticks, and what Grandpa would do, he had some connections with some of the believers in Toronto, and he would get the message out. if you got any young guys who would like to spend a summer on the farm, bring them to me, and you needed to know my grandpa. And he said, I'll make a man out of them. Okay, grandpa was in the military. He had a lot of experience there, but he loved farming. But they became part of the farm routine. You know, they'd be up early, 6 o'clock in the morning, and they would work hard. And then they would have their lunch, and it would be a good lunch. My grandma was an excellent cook, great desserts. So maybe this is where the desserts fit in. But again, it was all part of that training, all part of that equipping. And as I've thought about this, I thought, God knew what he was doing. He was preparing Moses for even greater leadership opportunity because he needed to be a shepherd. He was going to be called to lead people who were going to be stubborn. Would they murmur and complain? Just wait as we go through the series. Some of us are going to be going, enough is enough. You want to throttle these people, just like a shepherd at times might want to throttle one of those cute and cuddly sheep. God knew what he was doing, and he needed time, Moses, to prepare himself for real leadership. Well, there's one final course. And if it's not the primary course, it's a course that I think is maybe relevant for many of us this morning. I said Professor James only because I was thinking of James 1. Count it all joy when you fall into diverse trials or temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. But let patience have its perfect work, so that you may be perfect and entire, lacking nothing. I'm prepared to say, when I look at Moses' actions earlier in Exodus 2, that Moses wasn't a patient person. Moses, as a prince of Egypt, would have snapped his fingers and things would happen. So he saw a situation and it was very impulsive. It was a case of Moses kind of going into action. His leadership was raw. It was reckless. It was undisciplined. It was ungodly. And God said, Moses, we've got some work to do. You've had some of the best courses in Egypt. But now it was time for Moses to go into God's school. And one of the key courses in God's school in the desert is by Professor James, a course on patience, on waiting on God. I've said before, I'll say it again, I hate to wait. Some of you would say, no, I don't have a problem waiting in a grocery store or waiting in a lineup. At the college this past week, a young lady presented a devotional. And she got up and she said, you know what? She says, I'm a person who does not mind waiting. She says, if I have to wait for 30 minutes in a lineup at a grocery store, it doesn't bother me. If I have to wait 3 or 4 days for somebody to get back to me, it doesn't bother me. But this young lady with the 2 or 3 other students at the school is going on a mission trip to Peru. And she said, you know what? She says, I've got to raise funds to go to that on that mission trip. And she said, you know what, John, she said, and to the group, she said, the funds aren't coming in quickly. And I'm having to learn what it is to wait on God. And some of you this morning are going to go, these other courses are great, these other courses are good, and I maybe need this course and I need that course if there's an elective approach. But many of us know that one of the great challenges in life is waiting on God. What's next? What's that next great thing that God has for me? It's scary, isn't it? Because it would appear that God made Moses wait for 40 years. It's a long time to be in the school of the desert. In fact, Moses waited so long, as we're going to discover next Sunday, that when God called him out of a bush, Moses doesn't seem to be quite prepared, but God knew he was prepared. God knew he was ready because Moses had been in the school of the desert. Moses, 80 years old, we know that. And then God saying, now you're ready. For some of us, we might go, well, that's interesting. I've been doing a whole lot of leading, but God has something special for you, for me, and for this church. and often it will involve some time in the desert school. Long years, and then one day,